Welcome to Old Taku no Radio, episode 19 on Miss Hokusai. I'm Jared, and I am joined by the wonderful, incredible, slightly buzzed chief poetry and booze correspondent for Anagamers.com, Ink. Say hi, Ink.
Hi, Ink.
Okay, I have no intro for this, so why don't you just tell us about the summary for Miss Hokusai, Ink?
You bastard. Well, I'm going to steal it from A&M. It's 1814, and the city of Edo is one of the most populated homes of peasants, samurais, townsmen, merchants, nobles, artists, courtesans, and maybe even supernatural beings. Two residents are the highly accomplished artist, Tetsuo, and his talented 23-year-old daughter, Oe. Tetsuo gains worldwide acclaim as Katsuhika Hokusai, but few would know Miss Hokusai, the daughter who assisted him uncredited.
Thank you, A&N. I want to append just one thing to that, and that is powerful doggo.
Powerful doggy.
The Jared Nelson Old Talker No Radio episode 19 Miss Hokusai summary for me would be, there's this super adorable dog that lives in Edo in the 1800s, and he goes out in storms, and sometimes he sees dragons, and he's super cute. The end.
Not the end, because it's a puppy at first, and then it grows as the film goes. And,
yes.
You know, it's a puppy, and then it's doggy, but it's always, like, doing doggy things, and it's awesome.
And it doesn't do the dog movie thing of killing the dog and making the people sad. So the dog actually survives, guys. Like, best part of the movie, the dog survives.
Miss Hokusai wins because this anime does not hate doggies.
Yes. Yes, this is doggo approved.
Which will actually come into play when we talk about the art style. I can't believe there's a link there, but there is.
there is a link. There is a link. So this is a movie. It's a movie.
It is?
It is a movie.
It is. It's on Netflix, by the way. You can binge the hell out of this because it's 90 minutes long.
You can binge it repeatedly, over and over and over again.
In fact, it's a movie, so it's meant to be watched in one fell swoop.
So, how do we want to go about this, Ink? Do we want to talk about who Hokusai is and why anybody should give a damn? Is that a good place to start?
I think it's a fabulous place to start, and I think you should be the one to talk about Hokusai.
See what you did there. Hokusai is one of the, probably the most famous artist, probably in, like, overall, from Japan, at least internationally speaking. So, weebs, listen up. That big poster you have on your dorm room wall or your dining room or wherever you put giant wave posters that look very Japanese.
That would be on the banner to Wave Motion Cannon.
Shout out to our fam over there. Very true. That actually, you know, I think if we had a space like that, that would totally be a thing. But yeah, that's Hokusai, the big wave. It's called the Great Wave off Kanagawa. Sometimes I've seen it, the Great Wave, like under the Great Wave of Kanagawa, because there's like boats like under the wave. Y'all seen this? I don't need to explain that, y'all. That's Hokusai, and he has done many, 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 many more ukiyo-e. Woodblock prints, besides that one, but that's his most famous, and it's I think that's one from the 36 views of Fuji or something.
Mount Fuji, yes.
I think it's the first one, actually. But that's Hokusai, and this is actually not about him. He's kind of an asshole in this movie. This movie is about his very cool daughter, who would probably be fronting a metal band if she were in like a modern day or like a punk band. Probably a punk band, really.
She is a badass in this movie.
She pretty much is a badass.
I mean, you figure the time period this is placed in, this is, you know, classic Edo, and Japan is stunted as far as women's rights and viewpoints are going right now. picture like 200 years ago. And she's you know, granted she was uncredited, an uncredited assistant to her father for, I think, around 20 years, serving as sort of the backup and background painter and filler for his works. But she was highly accomplished in her own right and recognized as such by some of the her contemporaries.
And one thing we'll do, and this is a mental note to myself, but we will, in the show notes, we'll put some links to Hokusai's work and Oye, who is Hokusai's daughter, the title character. We'll put some links to her work as well.
Wait, is it Oye or Oe?
It's Oye. So like, Oye. Like.
Oh, good! I don't have two waifus with the same name.
It's not Oe. Yeah, like because the E is like a E and the I is a E, like sound. It's Oye, like Oye-san. So sometimes you'll see it romanized like Oye, and then one time I saw it.
It's like five different romanizations of her name. It's yeah. Really confusing.
One time I saw it romanized as O-U-I, and I can't help but in my worst, not at all French accent, go, oui, like every time I see that. So, like, I could not handle that. Like, that syntax was not great for me. But, yeah, it's Oye, and she's only got, I think, about 20 or so recognized prints, but they are amazing. One of the things that's really fascinating about her work is, I think, as a contrast to her father's, is the way that she uses light in a lot of her pictures. My favorite one of hers, and it actually shows up in the end credits of the movie, is this scene of I think it's titled something like a scene from a Yoshiwara brothel or something like that. We'll get the actual title in the show notes. But the lighting in that picture is so incredibly evocative. And I think it's hard to tell without knowing exactly what stuff she did under her father's name and like her own stuff in combination with that. But I think in a lot of ways she was her father's equal, at least, if not surpassing him in some of her just raw talent and ability to create these incredibly evocative scenes. And the stuff that she did on her own as herself is quite different in a lot of ways than what her father did.
Which is how generations should proceed. Like, you know, the daughter should outpass the father. Or surpass the father. And, you know, honestly, you look at Hokusai's work, and he was a woodblock artist, and his works are extremely wonderful and detailed and full, but the progression of technology, even as the generations passed, of the tools and skill sets that were available, you can tell that Oye took advantage of that. And you could see the difference in her work, like you said, especially with that the brothel painting, which does actually appear, or is at least nodded to, in this series. There's a scene. It's not from the same angle. It's not from the same perspective, and it doesn't accomplish the same things, which I was slightly disappointed by. But it's a great nod, just a wink to her artistry. But you can totally see how she surpassed her father. But her father's influence in the same swoop.
Looking at their different artistry styles is really interesting. And I think that they represent throughout the movie that they go out of their way to show different points of inspiration for both of those artists, for both Oye and Mr. Hokusai, I guess we call him.
Unless you care to try to pronounce his first name.
I forget his first name, but so Miss Hokusai, Oye calls him Tetsuzo, which is his, I guess, his actual name. Hokusai in his life went by over 30 some odd different names. It was kind of crazy. She and him have this really weird relationship, and not in like a squicky way. It's like in a strained kind of somewhat estranged but also very close kind of way. Hokusai himself is like an asshole in this movie.
He's not an asshole. He's just self-involved. And
dude's an asshole.
He's totally focused on his art. Like, everything else is secondary. His life is painting. That's it.
And he is unable to relate to people outside of a very narrow sort of comfort zone that is pretty much centered around his art. That's true. It also makes him an asshole.
In fact, the only reason we're really focusing on Oye here is the fact that she could paint, which made her father's favorite.
Yeah, well, like, I don't see, here now I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, because here's where I'm going to defend him a bit. I think that he just had a hell of a lot of trouble relating to people that did not see the visual world the way he did, or did not relate to the world in terms of, like, direct visual imagery and things like that. Because of that, and because she's able to connect with him on that artistic level, I think that enables them to have pretty much the stable relationship Hokusai has throughout his life.
I think you're touching on a very prime aspect, but there's something slightly askew from that, is the fact that, and this comes up a couple times during the movie, is it's not so much the art, but how you see life. And can translate that into art, because there's a moment where he's admonishing one of his pupils, one of his male pupils, and he says, you know, you don't have enough, basically, imagination, or you're too strict in your life view to actually render good art, because you're trying to be too literal. Whereas, you know, my daughter, she's great because she's got this imagination and can do things. And that's what I really think the core issue is.
I think that's a really good point to raise. You know, he does definitely see the world in that certain kind of way. Another thing this movie does, the way it portrays, and there's so many things this movie does I like. I would not have expected this movie to come from Keiichi Hara of Crayon Shin-chan fame.
Seriously.
This is not at all. I mean, this is one of those, like, kind of Ghibli but not really Ghibli movies.
Well, granted, he's adapting a manga that came out in, what, the 80s, 90s?
80s.
80s. So, you know, he has strict content to work with, but still, and this is actually one of the things I think I like that he brings to it, is the sense of humor. Because the sense of humor is necessary to show how round a character Oye is, as opposed to her father. And her father, like you mentioned, is someone who just focuses on the art, and that's it. Like, his life is painting. His raison d'etre is to communicate how he feels about what he sees to a wider audience. Whereas his daughter is obviously a more round individual who feels for her fellow humans, and that's where I like kind of the structure of this film, because the vignette style relates to specific paintings, and it will reference them, but the interludes where Oye is interacting with his fictional younger daughter, which never existed, that character exists to round out Oye as a human, because she is warm and tender and caring about something other than art.
Yeah. And younger daughter, to provide a little context there, as Ink said, fictional. In this movie, she is blind and has some health issues on top of that blindness. They don't really go into a lot of detail, and this is Edo era of Japan, so we're talking, you know, the last great era of the samurai, so not a ton of medical technology to really dive into what was wrong with her. But the blindness, I think, is a very intentional and powerful contrast to the way Hokusai sees the world. And because of this younger daughter's condition, Hokusai just doesn't interact with her, doesn't talk to her, doesn't really visit her much at all. At least in the beginning of the movie, you get this impression that this is almost a person that he because she has no capacity to connect with him kind of the way he sees the world. He doesn't know how to connect with her. And it's kind of – it's one of these things where, you know, in about the midpoint of the movie, there's an opportunity for him to actively just walk over and say hello to the little girl while she's out with Oye. And he just walks right by him. And it's a beautifully done scene. The way that it's lit and the way that it's angled and the sort of parallel movement of Oye and this younger daughter, and then Hokusai on the other side of the street, literally on the other side of the street, like walking by. Just a fascinating and beautiful shot. But it also kind of speaks to the relationship and the interpersonal dynamics, because, you know, Oye is on the other side of that street with that little girl, and you kind of see the emotional distance between Hokusai and both of his daughters, even though Oye lives with Hokusai and works with him so closely. It's their relationship at times feels more like a professional relationship than it does actually a familial bond.
But I think those two are intertwined in their relationship, which I actually applaud. That thought was a really good depiction of how she was raised and who she identifies with, because her mother is still very much alive. It's just she's living with her father for the majority of it, because she has this artistic inclination which follows her father. And she's kind of a daddy's girl, even though she's a badass and a bit of a rebel.
Yeah. Yeah, she's sort of begrudgingly – I mean, you get the sense that she hero worships her father to a degree, like his talent. She freely admits that his talent is beyond her own.
But only in her inner monologues, which I
only – yeah, yeah. She never does it like up front in person to people. And she does idolize him a bit, despite the fact that they have this complicated relationship where, you know, she definitely doesn't approve of the way that he treats the younger daughter.
But at the same time, I love the way the movie treats that, because – Hokusai doesn't know how to interact with people. He knows how to interact with paper and his own imagination and reality, but never directly with humans. So that scene you were talking about with him passing Oye and Onal on the street, where Oye is carrying Onal piggyback, and they never look at each other. They're all looking straight forward and passing on opposite sides of the street. You sense Hokusai focusing on whatever he's thinking of, which is probably art.
Yeah.
And you know Oye is focusing on Hokusai, focusing on art on the opposite side of the street, ignoring them. And it's such a strong, strong relationship to render visually, and it does it really well.
Yeah, you almost feel like Oye is about to do one of those, like, Saiyan power-up aura things walking by Hokusai, because you know she's getting pissed, like, every step she's taking past her father, that he's not acknowledging, not her, but not acknowledging Onal on her back. And it's such a great scene. It's probably one of my favorite moments of the whole movie.
It's kind of framed that way, too, because that does take a long time. That's probably one of the most centered cuts of the entire movie, because that takes, like, a solid 30 seconds to probably a minute to execute. And like you mentioned, like, the shading with the shades of the building interacting with the sunlight and how they cross with the characters as they're crossing each other is just fantastic and absolutely necessary to get across what's going on there.
Yeah, I think to describe it, and even as I'm describing it now, like, it sounds overdone, but like the emphasis that it's trying to establish in the shot, but in the context of the movie and when you're kind of in the emotional current of the movie, it feels like such just a powerful moment, and it really was. I think that's one of my favorite moments for sure. But the other one is the doggo and the dragon. Like, that is amazing.
Well, we can get to that on a lighter note. While we're still talking about now, I'd actually really love to focus on a lot of the visuals associated with her.
Because, oh, yeah.
You know, it helps round out Oye, to be sure. But there's some pluses and minuses with how Nao's perception is treated. And I think that's a really important thing to cover. Because Nao is the blind sister, but spoilers, when she's in bed and Hokusai visits her for the first time in the film, and she reaches out her hands to touch her father, the background turns black, and I love that effect. Like, that was really well chosen, because all of a sudden all she's feeling is his face. And while I don't like the fact that they didn't black out his body at all or just sort of focus on where her hands were, that was really well chosen, because there's nothing else in her world other than what she can see, and what she can see is what she can feel with her hands. They also adeptly portray her heightened sense of hearing from being deaf. When Oye is... awakened by Nao in the middle of the night, I'm turning into a cat, Nao, because there's a praying mantis crawling on the netting above the bed, and Nao awakens to that and bugs her sister to go and check. It's nothing that she can ever hear, but once she goes and investigates with the lantern, she sees this lightly crawling bug, which she then has to describe back to Nao to get her to go to sleep again. And it's just a wonderful moment, because you're getting all of this information. You're getting how sensitive the little sister is and how accommodating the big sister is. And it's a wonderful moment. This movie is full of those.
And that praying mantis is so beautifully rendered too. Oh, you just, man. You get just a heartbeat or two looking at it, but the face, there's this really tight close up on the head of the mantis, and then it sort of pulls back, and you're not sure at first what kind of insect it is, but then it pulls back and you're like, oh, it's a praying mantis, and then it pulls back to show the whole body, and it just sort of slowly kind of turns and walks away in another direction. And it's such a beautiful shot, and then it's coupled with this dialogue that comes right after it, where Oye is trying to placate and make sure Onao goes to sleep. and so Onao is like, was it small? Yeah. Was it cute? Yeah. like she doesn't give it, like Oye doesn't do it like I just did it. She doesn't give anything away with her voice, but you could tell with her face, it's like, sure.
Yeah, she has to sound interested to actually, you know, engage her younger sister.
Yeah. It's just a great interaction, and to your point earlier, Ink, it's another example of the depth and of characterization they give both of these daughters, and particularly Oye.
So what was your feeling upon seeing the Totoro scene? Because that was, if I'm not mistaken, a total ripoff of the Totoro scene. With some very minor adjustments.
Yeah, it was definitely a thing, and it was pretty blatant. That it kind of took me out of it a little bit, honestly.
Me too.
A rare misstep with this movie, I think, could have been handled a little differently, I think.
A little more subtly, yeah. But something that I do applaud that scene for, and with a great deal of subtlety, is that while the Totoro knockoff is disappointingly identifiable, what I do love is that whole scene, while sort of evoking that Totoro sense of amazement on the part of Nao, is recognizing, or rather, Oye recognizing that there are people that are willing to accept and treat Nao normally, in the form of that small child who just sort of goes up to her and wants now to react. So he starts playing with the snow and the trees and her ultimately. And I love the fact that that scene, while, you know, sort of evoking that Totoro sense of amazement, utterly is about someone watching that as opposed to that happening. It's about Oye becoming comfortable with now interacting with the world. And that's such a big sister thing to do. It's you know, she's protective and she's letting her guard down a little to allow her little sister to interact with things. And I thought that was shown so beautifully. I was like, that's awesome. But like you, I was taken out by the whole similarity.
Yeah, I will say, I think they sold, within the context of the movie itself, I think they sold both parts of that scene quite well. I think, like you, the point of that I really appreciated was how it's really still a scene about Oye, even though the action is really happening around Onao and the realizations that she's having. And I thought that was very well done. And it was a very heartwarming scene. One of the heartwarming scenes that you have to have, I guess, as you build up a character that is then taken away from you to kind of maximize your shock over it, I guess. But so as we said, you know, Onao, the younger daughter, is not in the best of health. Her health begins to deteriorate, which leads to Hokusai painting this painting of some sort of Buddhist deity. I'm not sure which one, but he paints this beautiful depiction of this warrior god with in red ink, and has Oye take, I think Oye takes the painting over, or maybe he takes the painting over. But the whole idea of this was for it to ward off evil spirits and to ward off sickness. And that leads pretty quickly to that scene that we talked about earlier, where Hokusai actually does come to visit Onao, and she's touching his face with her hands. And oh, that scene got me a little bit. It was it was just really well done, really poignant. But eventually, Onao passes away, and there's this sort of gust of wind that blows through and blows all the papers out the tiny little house that Hokusai and Oye live in. And there's a single, what is it, like a camellia, I think? It's a tsubaki in Japanese. A camellia, I think.
Tsubaki.
Yeah, that's on the ground in the floor of the house. And that was the same flower that Oye gave Onao in like one of the very first scenes you see them together in. And the big wind blowing through is a symbolism you've seen in other Japanese stuff, where, you know, the spirit is sort of transitioning from the physical world to the spirit world. And kind of one of the interesting conceits of this, and this is why I'm bringing this up now, because I think it pivots us nicely to the supernatural, is this is a time and an age where that is just kind of accepted as, oh, that person's moving on. You know, like, and that's sort of the reaction Hokusai has. He says, you know, something quite tender for him. He says, oh, you've gone on ahead or something. And, you know, he looks, you know, shaken by it, but sort of accepting it too, as just sort of the course of life and karma. And you get this sense that Hokusai is pretty religious in some ways. I think in actual life he was like a Pure Land Buddhist or something like that, but the supernatural, and particularly imagery of Buddhism, is very important in not only the art that Oye and Hokusai do, except the proto hentai art that they do. That's a whole different subject, which Oye is actually really good at. The supernatural and Buddhist symbolism elements in the movie are really, really pronounced and kind of kind of run throughout the movie. That gets us back to the doggo and the dragon, which is still my favorite thing.
Not quite. Not quite. Because that actually leads into something else through two specific episodes, or two specific vignettes within this movie. And what I like is how they blend the realms, so to speak, between believability and creation, because this series applies a very practical lesson in art very early on, and that's something akin to closed-mindedness keeps your work mediocre at best, which is what Hokusai is telling one of his younger male proteges. And then the same thing is exemplified via a separate story about the trip to see a famous courtesan, which feels sort of like a nod to Hokusai's long-necked woman, in which case, Oye, the male pupil, and Hokusai, all are called to this courtesan's bedside upon a ringing of a bell, which her head, or the spirit of her head, is loosed from her body and just winds out of her neck and is entrapped by this net. And it's a very surrealist, magical realism scene. But it evokes all of Hokusai's work with the supernatural. And it's just wonderful because it's, you know, it also calls back to, you know, if you can't break the rules, you're not an artist, and no one's going to be interested in this. And it's important to notice because the anime does it in the fact that it's blending a tale about like a historical fiction, but it's introducing supernatural elements, saying these are not necessarily disparate.
Yeah, and it doesn't, it lets you kind of make the decision whether or not this is actual supernatural stuff happening or just incredibly powerful imaginations on the part of these two genius artists, because they, in the scene with the long-necked woman, they explicitly show the fact that Oye and Hokusai can see this distended spirit of the courtesan sort of entrapped and floating around in this space between the net, but the apprentice guy, who's not really into the art in this on the same level as Hokusai or his daughter, he doesn't really see it at all until the spirit basically shows up like right in front of his face, pushing through the net to sort of give the face something physical in relief for him to look at, and then he's freaking out. But Oye and Hokusai just kind of follow it along around the room as it's floating around, and then eventually it goes back into the woman. And apparently, I was reading up, doing a little research ahead of the show for once, and that kind of phenomenon where the supernatural phenomenon of living people being able to haunt other people through, like, sending their spirit out of their body while they're sleeping is an actual that has some mythological, I guess, kind of roots in Japanese folklore. So that was kind of cool that they wove that in there. And it was also cool in the way that, you know, it evokes the sense of magical realism, but it's kind of magical realism with a question mark. And as opposed to our last month's show, Eccentric Family, where it's like, no, that magic is a thing and supernatural creatures are a thing. Here it's very murky as to whether or not it's true or not. The way the characters talk about it, it's just a thing that happens. It's just sort of accepted. But that sort of runs replete through the entire movie, even though the movie is kind of episodic in a way in its storytelling. Now can I talk about the doggo and the dragon?
Now you can talk about the dog and the dragon.
Yay! So right at the beginning of the movie, Oye is watching Hokusai paint this incredibly elaborate picture of a dragon, and she's smoking while she's watched him do this. And a little bit of ash from her pipe falls onto the painting and burns a hole in it and ruins the whole painting. And then Hokusai just draws this big slash through it and storms off. And this leads to a story about the real way to paint a dragon is to wait for a storm to come and the dragon will descend from the sky. And then when it does, you have to capture it in the painting before it gets away. And sure enough, a storm brews and little doggo goes outside in a storm, which proves how much of a badass this dog is, because I don't know of a single dog that would ever do this. Certainly not Kane, but anyway, he's standing out in the storm almost like he's waiting for the dragon to show up. And then you're kind of waiting yourself for the dragon to show up. And sure enough, out of the storm comes this dragon. And it begins to descend, and you see wind swirling around and blowing around. And then it cuts to a scene of Oye finishing up this painting of the dragon. And it's a really, really awesome looking dragon. And you see that. That's one of the first scenes in the movie. So it really sort of sets the tone for, hey, all kind of crazy stuff's going to happen in this movie, and supernatural stuff is a thing. It's just going to happen, and people are just going to kind of talk about it like it's just like changing the oil in your car, you know, or, you know, going to buy groceries, you know, capturing a dragon in a painting so you can have a good dragon painting, you know, just the normal stuff.
It really does do a good job of setting the tone, like you said, because without that supernatural influence on perceived nature, honestly, that's what art is. It's just imagination placed upon reality. And when there are a couple of there's a discourse that precedes that magical sort of moment, and it's Hokusai talking with his pupil saying, or his pupil saying, you know, no, this is how a dragon reveals itself to you, and this is how you can actually depict a dragon, is when it comes out of a storm and drops its, you know, essence into your life, and then you are able to render it. So, in essence, you are waiting for the muse.
That's a good way to think about it, yeah. I think something I've been trying to say, and I haven't made the words work yet, but to convey how the supernatural is treated in this movie, the supernatural is the mundane in a way. It's just a thing that happens. It's just stuff. And
that's a strength.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's done. Like, I love that in this movie, that's just accepted, because that means imagination and art are just accepted. They're a part of nature. They're a part of life. What a wonderful world.
That's also done in a different aspect as well. There's a moment where Oye visits a male brothel, or at least a brothel that has male attendees as well, and she notices a painting on the wall, and the person who's with her starts elaborating upon a dream he had, where three gods start marching through a village and start crushing people. In the flashback that is the male, you know, thinking upon his dream, it's all stick figures and line drawings of this village and these gods trampling over people in agony, and it's all very well depicted. Like, you could tell the stick people are in agony. But then when Oye has a dream, you know, thinking about the themes of that person's dream, her dream is depicted a very much more artistically rendered way. So you get this impression of how her mind translates visuals better than the average man, because she has almost the exact same dream. She's under the foot of these gods marching through the village, but they're no longer stick figures. They're fully 3D rendered, you know, things about to crush her. And it feels weightier, and it feels more imperative. And it's just a wonderful little nod to how an artist processes the world versus the layman.
That's such a an interesting contrast too, because you kind of get the sense from Hokusai that he sees the world in that way. This is a scene that really drives it home that, yeah, oh yeah, Oye sees the world very much like her father does. She's just got better social skills. And that's really what kind of separates her from her dad in terms of how she relates to the world. But that one of the things I wanted to touch on is the reason that she goes to the brothel is because she is getting frustrated on a couple of different levels. She's getting frustrated with, like, all of the men in her life are kind of buffoons of various shades. And I mean, like, it's not like played up. I mean, like, two guys, one she's interested in, who puts the moves on her and thinks that and she thinks maybe they could be an item. They could have a future together. Then she sees him with another girl, and it's like, oh, it's a very John Hughes moment in this movie, because it's like she's got a ticket. There's an extra ticket that she ends up getting to go to this kabuki play, and the guy she's interested in is going to be there, and she's getting ready to go to that. She's thinking about it, and then this other guy shows up who we meet at the first part of the movie, and he's a friend of the male apprentice to Hokusai, and he clearly likes Oye, but he's just sort of this kind of big, dumb country goofball kind of character, and he takes her out, and she goes with him to kind of just hang out, and oh, we'll go to the shrine and pray, and she jokes that she prays for a safe birth, and this was after she went to the courtesan's place, and it's pretty funny. But I wasn't sure if she was joking or not, but because that's just kind of how Oye is. But you know, there's this whole kind of date montage where she's not quite as invested in it as he is. Then she decides to go to the Kabuki Theater, and she sees the guy she actually likes with another girl. Then she decides not to go to the Kabuki Theater, and she throws the ticket in the water. I mean, good God, this is 80s teen movie shit, like all over the place. In each of her interactions with these guys, like, each of these guys is kind of just not connecting with her. And, you know, for the kind of dumb country idiot guy whose name I forget because he's pretty forgettable, you know, he's doing all the I'm trying too hard kind of things on their date, and she's just totally not into it.
Which love is shown and not told.
Oh, yeah.
It's totally just represented right in your face, and you recognize it immediately.
Yeah, like, she is not even remotely interested. And the guy she is interested in, turns out that he's catting around with all the ladies. And that kind of just breaks her heart a little bit. And then her dad is just this freaking weird kind of asshole guy who is still funny in his own way.
I found him relatable. It's just me, but... I totally got him. It's like, yeah, Hokusai bro.
You have better people skills than this movie version of Hokusai. I will say, this movie is so good. So we mentioned the director earlier. If you haven't seen this movie, to give you a sense of the art and the visuals, our director is Hiroshi Ono, who did Kiki's Delivery Service and Wolf Children, a couple other things.
Which is kind of an odd mix, because his projects are not historical in nature most of the time. There's Chevalier Dion?
Something. Chevalier, I think?
Yeah, Chevalier.
I don't know. I don't speak French.
That sounds good. But that's, you know, at least... atmospheric, atmospherically historical. It looks good. It is appropriate. The rest is sort of fantasy and not true to history. This is pretty straight on and feels pretty straight on.
Yeah, it's not a combination you think of: Crayon Shin-Chan director and Kiki's Delivery Service art director. and think that that's going to work, but it does so beautifully in this movie. Hmm. There's throughout this movie, there's this sense of the rhythm of life and just daily life in Edo. And I think it does such a good job of capturing that. And it kind of tries to make a point of the just kind of constant, ever-changing, ever-flowing pace of life in this city. And even at the end of the movie, the bridge that is famously shown in one of Hokusai's paintings, I think, or maybe it's Ohie's, they cut to like what this looks like in the modern day, and it's there's still a bridge there. It's much more modern looking, and there's tall buildings everywhere, but it gives you this sense of permanence in this impermanent world where everything is built out of wood, and a fire can happen, and it's a big, big deal because it could destroy the whole city.
Which actually makes me want to interject something. There's a lot visually that this movie does, but it does feel like an anime. And one of the things that I held against it was One Piece had a vignette called Combustible, which was entirely woodblock print, ukiyo-e art. And I think it pulled it off a lot better than this anime. And I think the art direction in Miss Hokusai could have benefited from a little more implementation of imitation. And it seldom did.
Like, just to clarify what you mean with imitation there, do you mean being a little bit more evocative of the ukiyo-e style?
Correct. There are certainly moments where certain characters are reduced to sketches, and there are crumbled up paper balls made of entire screenshots.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very admirable things done visually, but none of them are quite as evocative as I think they should have been or could have been, at least in certain instances. And I missed those because I kept thinking back to Combustible, and I was like, oh man, that was great. Why isn't that here? And, you know, it doesn't have to be, but it was just something lacking visually that I was lamenting.
I think that's true. I agree largely. I think one place where they get close to that, but they still fall a bit short, is the depiction of hell that Oye does. Mm. That's super, super good and over the top, but it's not quite complete, and it ends up kind of haunting the lady who's the wife of the lord that bought the painting.
Which also, did you notice, cues into our last episode of Eccentric Family.
The Eccentric Family had that same painting in it.
Well, not only that, it had the same painting, but it also had the painter having to add in the Buddha.
Right.
To add that sort of sense of completion and wholesomeness to that scene, and the serenity that it affected, that is the humanity observing the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And I love that. I love that trifecta of interaction there.
Yeah. So this painting of hell basically gave the lady of the house no way out of the engagement with the work. And that's the kind of work you want to be able to disengage from, because it's an incredibly graphic, horrific depiction of hell and all of the various things that happen and will happen to you, like dragons eating you, or you being lit on fire, or being like eaten by demons, or pulled apart, or like all these different things.
Although I'm going to throw a wrench into the works and say that's the ultimate form of art of an artist. It's someone who leaves you wanting. It's someone that leaves you engaged. Because whereas Hokusai said, no, you got to wrap this all up, no loose ends, Oye says, no, I accomplished everything I wanted to, and has this open-ended painting that leaves the viewer constantly engaging with the painting. And like, what is better for an artist than that? But in the end, she does end up saying, "Oh, my father's artistry is better than mine," which is kind of horrible. I didn't like that because she had outshone her father at that point because she trapped her viewer in the painting. How awesome is that?
It's awesome when the painting's not hell, Inc. That's the whole point, dude. Like that's... I get what you're saying. I do. But I think that to trap the person engaging your work and wrap them kind of permanently in it, I think that's really cool. But also, particularly with a work like...
Hell?
That you have to... You have to offer some sort of path out of that. Like it's like a horror movie you can't get out of. Eventually you're gonna want to get out of that thing. And that was the problem for the lady of the house was she was so enthralled by the power of this visual presentation that she could not extricate herself from it. And it began to sort of poison her mind and her spirit to where she's literally seeing demons where there are none, and ends up starting a fire over it, which got contained. And the beauty of that is she, you know, is so afraid of the fires of hell, and yet she catches something on fire and is nearly consumed. But I think I agree with Hooksai on this, like especially with that kind of piece where you're putting. You're putting your viewer through something really hard, you know, leading them back to a place where they can sort of have some safety from it. I think it's important.
And I think that reflects overall what this anime does. This is very much a piece about reconciliation between not only father and daughter, but artist and viewer.
That was beautiful. Don't put that in the podcast, but that was beautiful and so true. One of the things I really appreciate about this movie that doesn't really in such a visual movie, and this is an intensely visual movie in many ways, I really like the music. I like all the music. I like the score that's more traditional. And I love the rock songs just like thrown in there. Usually when Oye is doing something, the first time I heard the rock song at the front of this, I was like, oh, I wasn't expecting that. But it was sort of a pleasant kind of surprise. I think if they had overplayed it and like had like rock riffs in like every scene, that would have bothered me. You know, sometimes people make a similar critique about Rakugo, how it has too much music in it during the storytelling.
Rakugo's was so fitting, though. Like, it was perfect. Every turn.
It was perfect. And I think that they did the same thing here by very limited application of modern music to sort of punctuate the ancient music and the ancient scenes that we're looking at.
See, I'm gonna disagree with you here. Because I fully agree. Like, I totally got where they were going with the modern rock guitar riffs, trying to accentuate Oye's badassness. But she's already badass the way she's written and drawn. She has the full-on, you know, Amanda Palmer eyebrows. She has the demeanor of someone who has not been taught to be feminine in this time of flourishing Edo. She is just herself and whoever she has inherited from her dad. And I liked the guitar at first, the modern rock guitar, because I thought it was going for like a Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette sort of thing. And I thought that was going to be the tone throughout the entire movie, and that the music was just going to be that and in your face and like, no, I am punk. I am, you know, more than my father. I am defying the art and the times, and I am going to be through music. And I was like, okay, then why is the next scene Biwa and Taika. and you know, I was like, no, this is immediately dissonant to me, and it's taking me out of the film. And it's not as much a thing in the middle of the movie as it is at the bookends, because the first made me think it was going to be something it wasn't, and then during the middle, it kind of worked, but during the end, it didn't, because it wasn't finishing the way it was.
And yeah.
I really didn't like that. It took me out in ways I didn't want to be taken out, and I don't think it really gelled with most of the movie, especially with the discordant feel of the end of the movie, which I don't know if you had the same feelings about.
I liked the music just overall, period. I liked the rock interludes in there. The very first one kind of comes at a point where you see Oye and you get a sense for personality, and there was something about that song that I'm like, okay, so she's like Joan Jett if she lived in the 1800s and was the daughter of the most famous ink block painter ever, but she probably did like so much of his stuff that like half of it's her and all that. Cool. All right. Character established. Got it. And so I guess it worked for me. I didn't think it was overdone. I think it was music that fit the character that in a way kind of speaks to how she's modern in a lot of ways, that she's not, like, she's kind of ahead of her time in some ways, and that's kind of the sense it evoked for me. As for the ending of the movie, I agree, it was a bit disjointed at the end. I think it's hard to do this kind of movie with the structure that it had and stick that landing well. That's not an excuse, but I don't think I had the reaction you did to it, but the ending was got a little rough at the end, but I like how they gave it this sense of continuity there at the end by cutting to the modern day and all that. But yeah, I tend to agree with you.
See, I get the want to tie it to the modern day, but I lament the fact that it doesn't, because where this movie really ends is Oye's depiction of her younger sister dying, or her fascination with the goldfish that Oye gave her, that she could see without seeing. And that was beautiful, because it was something she wasn't supposed to be drawing, or more of a juxtaposition. She was supposed to be drawing a very beautiful woman, and she drew her younger sister watching these fish even though she couldn't see. And that's such a powerful, powerful juxtaposition. And then they stop the movie and they say 1 year later, and they go into whatever. And it's horrible to me. It was such a bad decision. I was like, really? That was your ending? Right there was everything emotionally powerful about that movie, about her, and you ripped it away by lingering. No, art is a moment, and that decision to defy a depiction of beauty as a paid-for moment of pleasure versus a observation of humanity was detrimental to the landing of this film, which is otherwise like a beautiful execution. Even though like what follows isn't bad, but still the decision not to stop there, to me, felt like a trip.
Maybe they felt some pressure to turn this into more of a biopic, or maybe they felt like it would be incomplete to leave out the sort of, oh yeah, Hokusai goes on to live till like 90, and then he laments the fact that he doesn't have any more years to live, and blah blah blah. And this still isn't a movie about Hokusai, but
which admittedly is a good ending point. Like that whole, if I had 10 more years, if I had 5 more years, is wonderful. but it's about Hokusai. It's not about Hokusai's daughter.
Right. And then she marries, I mean, and it's kind of funny, like, again, this is like kind of the most punk rock thing she could, like, this is so punk rock of her, like, just sitting on a bridge kind of explaining, yeah, I go on, I marry somebody for like a little while, it doesn't work out, and I divorce him, I move back in with my father, and I stay around till he dies at 90. And it's sort of like the casual kind of way that she explains, you know, their destinies and everything. It's just I liked the delivery of it.
But I
agree with you, not needed, because this wasn't really a biopic. Like it was a biopic in the sense that you have three or four different sort of impressions. Well, maybe a few more than that, because it's just a collection of scenes together rather than a coherent three line through the movie. But you have this collections of scenes that sort of give you an impression of this young woman and her relationship with her father and her attempts at romance and awkward social interactions with the opposite sex and figuring herself out and you know, doing research to make better proto hentai and all that stuff, and her relationship with her younger sister that didn't really exist in real life but is great for the movie. You get all of that, and there's not really a need to get true biopic kind of end block like description of everything that's kind of happening at the end of these people's lives and what they go on to do. I don't feel like that was ever necessary. I feel like she could have just even just monologued a bit and like walked off the bridge or something.
That's pretty much what she does, though.
Yeah, like did something cool, you know. Like I would have been okay with kind of a last scene showing her later doing cool art stuff. Like that would have been cool.
That's kind of the thing, though. Like most of her life is a mystery. There's not a lot of fact about her left, sadly. There's a few prints. There's what's known of where she came from and who she was involved with, but not a lot of where she ended up. So this very fictionalized account of this amazing figure is left to the winds. And I love the fact that this anime can just sort of take her wherever it wants to go, but at the same time, I kind of lament not knowing where she went.
Yeah, in actual history, Oye, after her father dies in 1849, a few years after that, she disappears and is never heard or seen from again. But it is noted that one of the things she was interested in doing was becoming a Taoist sage. So maybe she wandered off and became a Taoist sage, and, you know, that's Miss Hokusai 2 Electric Boogaloo. Who knows? Maybe it's her wandering around, like, being a Taoist sage and, like, banishing demons. I would read that manga. But, yeah, it is a true tragedy that we don't have more of this woman's art, of this woman's viewpoint on the world. Because I'm telling you, like, night scene in the Yoshiwara district is one of the most beautiful kind of evocative Japanese pieces of art I've ever seen. I love it, love it, love it. And only really discovered it as I started preparing for the podcast.
Same here. And there's actually a few of her pieces that are at least, like I said, nodded to it throughout the film. And I love the fact that it wasn't shot-per-shot representations, more of just sort of, you know, well, like nods to it. It was very well done.
Yeah, yeah. One of the interesting things conceptually and historically about the time in which Oye lived and in which Hokusai lived is this is right at the very end of Japanese history before the Tokugawa shogunate is forced to open the country when Commodore Perry sails in with the black ships that, you know, steamships basically, that for the first time in, you know, probably 300 years or so, Japan's had to open up again to outside Western contact. For most of the Tokugawa era, they didn't have to do that. So the point in the Edo period that we're seeing is kind of right before this massive amount of change happens in the country. It leads to the Meiji Restoration and modern Japan as we know it. So really fascinating time, because I think in a lot of ways, this is a time in Japanese history that people are nostalgic for, kind of in a way similar to how some Americans are nostalgic for their idea of what the Old West was like. So interesting.
Revolutionary period.
Or the Revolutionary period. Very interesting point in history to have this kind of picture in. And, you know, fascinating subjects too. So probably ready for Twitter questions, aren't we?
I think so.
So the first one is from Helen at Wandering Dreamer on Twitter.
Who, if you don't know of, she was our previous guest on Old Talk to No Radio for the Eccentric Family podcast.
And her question was, how well did you guys feel that the movie was structured? She says she personally liked the movie, but found the parts were a little too disparate. And I think she's right to a degree. At least she's right in her own opinion, of course. But like, I tend to agree with her on some level that I think that I think towards the end, it was a little too kind of all over the place. But I can overlook it. It didn't bother me that much.
I actually like the structure. One of its strengths is how it balances the influence Hokusai had on Oye versus how Oye lived. And it's a perception of how she lived through art and how she lived as a human. And that contrasts her father greatly, and I think that's what defines her, because she has this humanity and this astounding artistic talent. And how she combines those two, I think, is really what the film set out to do in doing this film in vignettes. It's not just trying to explore paintings in the realm of fictional narration. It's showing the growth of a human under circumstances where she's taught to be analytical and deny her humanity, yet growing up with humanity trying to absorb art.
Yeah, I feel like this movie would have been a lesser work if it were more of a chronological, traditional biopic kind of piece. It also kind of can't be, because we just really don't know a whole lot about Oye in real life. Yeah. We just don't. We don't know nearly as much about her as Hokusai, and I think that's kind of one of the points, really, that the movie subtly makes, is, you know, this brilliant woman has been overshadowed by a man, her father, and having this movie be about her is a little bit of small justice that sadly she'll never know about.
And forced to be overshadowed in some instances, because it's shown in the film where, you know, Hokusai abandons a project, whether it's due to Oye's childish reactions as to burning that picture of the dragon, or other reasons, but she takes up his abandoned works and finishes them, and is expected to, because she's his protege.
Right.
Because she's not yet married, and therefore, you know, expected to inherit the family business, and, you know, oh, well, I don't want to do this, so you have to, sort of thing. There's a great sense of burden placed upon her that's evident in the film, and I love that it goes without saying or a direct narration during the movie.
There is the only kind of nod to that you see in terms of positive movement is towards the end of the movie. So Hokusai basically says to Oye, I was talking to my patron, and he thinks that you're ready to do your own work now. And he's sort of proud of her in that moment. And that kind of comes as a bit of a victory, kind of a triumph late in the movie. But it speaks to exactly that, Inc. And I think the movie would be less disjointed if they hadn't tried to do the thing they tried to do at the end. Mm. Or it would feel less disjointed. A bonus question she has is what is your favorite Hokusai work, or will y'all be revealed as fake art history fans?
Jared.
Mine, so obviously I love The Wave, right?
Not obviously. I mean, it's prevalent, but you don't have to love it.
So I have kind of a two-part answer. I do love The Wave. I love the menace in that wave. The wave, if you look at the crest of the wave, the great wave off Kanagawa, it all of the surf kind of looks like grasping hands trying to reach for the people in these boats, and it looks like it's coming for them, and it's just, oh, I love that. It's so evocative. But my other kind of favorite one is also in the 36 views of Mount Fuji. It's this one called Find Wind, Clear Morning, and it's sometimes known as Red Fuji. It's this painting of this bold blue background with white clouds, kind of long, stringy streaks of cloud kind of layered throughout the painting. And then to contrast, you've got this green dappled forest, and then it yields this just incredibly vivid red peak of Mount Fuji. And there's a bit of almost maybe a snow cap of some kind on top. And the contrast of this upward motion of Mount Fuji and this bold red color that it has, contrasting with the blue and the white of the clouds and the green of the forest, it's just a beautifully simple but evocative piece.
You're obviously the most cultured of both of us. Also, the thing was Rowdy Sumo Wrestler Matsutaro, where both Matsutaro and his sensei get blind-ass drunk and barrel through the streets on this absconded automobile, and they end up running through a bathhouse, and most bathhouses have a depiction of Mount Fuji on their tiles in the background near the baths, and the sensei had been wanting to see Mount Fuji all throughout the series, and all of a sudden, in this drunken rampage, they actually ram through a bathhouse and end up almost crashing through the wall. And just as they're about to hit the wall, the sensei goes, "Mount Fuji!" And they crash into the wall. And that was the fantastic
Mount Fuji
reference.
I am so glad that you made me remember that piece of shit anime series.
That was fantastic. What are you kidding me?
Come on. Forgot. Where wrestling anime is concerned, you are a diehard fan.
Right.
I also want to plug again Night Scene in Yoshiwara by the title character Miss Hokusai, Katsushika Oe.
It is really beautiful.
It is so gorgeous. And it looks like, when I look at this, and I'm looking at it right now as I'm talking, but when I look at this,
it's burned into my memory. I don't even have to look at it. I looked at it once, and it stays there.
The light in it is so gorgeous and so well done. And kind of structurally, visually, the way that the painting is set up, it's sort of a spiritual cousin in my mind anyway, it's a spiritual cousin to that painting of the diner with people sitting in it that people have riffed on to death now in American folk art and pop art. But it has that sort of voyeuristic sort of, you're looking into this other world kind of feel to it. And the way that she does the light this is ink block stuff, man. This is the same style that her dad did, but like just on a whole nother level. I mean, I think she surpassed Hokusai in terms of trying to bring realism into things and showing, you know, Hokusai did this later in his life too, but trying to show more actual scenes of life, not just scenes of nature or paintings of the Buddha or whatever.
And this is what I was kind of disappointed with and impressed with the anime, was the slight nod to that scene. Because there are two moments. There's one during the daylight and one during nighttime. And the painting you're mentioning is depicted at night, because there's encroaching blackness all around, but there's an interior lit scene where none of the courtesans are recognizable because the pillars are all in front of their faces as if it's a cage. And it's depicting that essence of that scene, that social strata. And
yeah.
During an earlier moment, during the daylight, and during the night scene as well, some of the courtesans' faces can be seen, and I didn't like that. I like the nod, but what Oye was trying to convey was not conveyed via the anime, and I thought that was a huge loss or a huge misstep on the point of the animators and the conceptual artists in general. I don't think it added anything to have the courtesans' faces seen. I may be missing something.
Nah, I mean, it's up to interpretation, right? I do like the call out about how.
I mean, they are women, right? So they do deserve to be seen. Maybe that's it.
Right.
So maybe it's a modern call out to that. Maybe they shouldn't be hidden. Maybe they should be in your face.
Yeah, and you know, this is her depicting, you know, these beautifully dressed, perfectly made up, perfect hair, you know, courtesans in this box, in this sort of, and it, and the slats in the front give it that cage feel. You know, I think that's a very intentional positioning with perspective, and you know, it's really. Oh, it's just a great painting, and so much texture, so much detail, just throughout. So art is awesome. Next question
My favorite Hokusai work.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought you were just gonna talk about that damn sumo anime again.
No. That's cool. It's fun. It's a thoroughly enjoyable anime. You should all watch Monsutaro. But my favorite Hokusai work is actually a collection of Hokusai work from 100 Poets, 100 Poems. It's a hardbound anthology that matches up Hokusai's work with the Ogura. I'm forever going to mispronounce this.
The Hyakuin. Yeah, oh, the Hyakuin issue?
Thank you. I cannot pronounce that word. I cannot say that at all. but it matches up prints of his with the poems, which never actually, you know, coincided. But it's fantastic nonetheless, and I love reading the poems and panning over to those images. It just seems wonderful to me.
That's awesome. The next question is from Muscle Robo, which, gotta say, freaking love that name.
I knew
that's
you would.
Really great. Holy crap. Everybody go follow Muscle Robo like right now, just because Muscle Robo, my God, what a great handle. Have you read the manga is the question. And the answer is no.
No here too.
To my knowledge, this manga, it's a bit old now. This manga has not been licensed that I know of. Now, I know that doesn't mean that it's not out there somewhere, but for all intents and purposes, there's no legal accessible way to view this manga. And if there is, please let us know, because we would love to check it out.
Seriously, because there's a lot that could have been done.
And there's a lot that may not have shown up in the movie that is in the manga that we could dive into.
So let's. What may have been possible in the manga that you would have liked to have seen?
Hell, I don't know. I would let the manga tell me that. I mean, her, you know, fighting demons or, like, aliens invading? Like, Oye, in the film at least, is just, again, we've said badass a lot. But, like, the way this film is done and the way that supernatural shit is just mundane, if an Oni, like, popped up in the street, I would halfway expect Oye to just, like, pull out, like, a bunch of exorcism tools out of her sleeves and just deal with it and then, like, go buy, you know, a bowl of ramen or something. Like, I mean, it would just happen. So, I mean, but to answer your question more seriously, I don't know. I would like more depth. I would like more detail. I would like to see if the manga is a more chronological story or if it's just more vignettes. More vignettes would be cool. I don't know. How about you?
See, I was thinking more of the the artistic execution, because there are a number of moments in the anime where it strips away the modern animation feel and goes more towards sketches and more towards woodblock at certain points. But I was thinking, like, if this was anime, or if this was a manga, how would the frames dissolve into woodblock from, say, modern manga perspective? Like, modern manga style. You know, and how would that transition, and what effect would that have on the reader? Because that, to me, would seem more of a pleasant dissolve than what took place in the anime. What took place in the anime was obvious, and not distractingly so. It was entertaining, but I think on paper, where both Hokusai and Oye lived, I think that would be a more fitting transition for transition visually than anime. And I would like to see how pages handled it.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, that's I hadn't thought of that. That's a great point. Yeah, would definitely love to read that. Third question is from Vincenzo Avrello, who is, of course, Vinny Ave AGC, our Gyo Tokyo Fish Attack victim.
You could call him our Gyoto man.
Please send all hate mail for that to evanminto@anagamers.com, please. So Vinny's question, he quite enjoyed the film. Given the vignette nature of it, do you think there could be more stories told, or what other artists would you like a film like this about? Let's split that up. Do we think there could be more stories told? I think that calls back to what we were talking about with the manga. It's entirely possible that there are. Would certainly love to see more. I mean, I wouldn't want a sequel to Miss Hokusai unless she does become some sort of Taoist seer and is banishing demons, and it's basically Ushio and Tora, but with Miss Hokusai. That would be cool. But failing that, I don't need another movie, but maybe the manga's got more stories in it.
It could, and I think largely it depends on the amount of work that Oye has left behind. And given that's minimal, I really don't think there's any more vignettes to be told. The pieces that she left behind are endearingly sewn into this anime, at least from the articles I've read. Most of the scenery and the images that she had created are at least nodded to in the film, and I don't think there's a need for a sequel, because more conjecture would be meaningless without substance, you know, what she wanted to say. And I love the fact that this film does incorporate both her and her father's work, because they're interjoined in more ways than one. She was responsible for the completion of a number of her father's works and caring for her father until his death. So they're intertwined throughout history for that, and he is responsible in part for her nurturing and mentoring in the ways of art. So, you know, they're inseparable that way. And this film nicely blends that while acknowledging her competence.
Cool. What other artists would you like a film like this about? Does this work with other artists? Are there other artists that we would rather just get a vignette kind of like highlight reel of, rather than seeing like a chronological biopic kind of format?
Well, there was that, I haven't seen it, but there was that Van Gogh animated biopic, and I think that would be along the same lines. And Dave McKean had that wonderful Mirror Mask film, which I'm not sure really exemplifies sort of a biopic thing, but kind of represents him as a whole. I can't really think of any others.
I can think of at least one. I think this would be a cool, like, I would like to see an anime film sort of like this about Leonardo da Vinci. So not an exhaustive friggin' chronological, I mean, Jesus, that'd be a trilogy of damn movies. But like, just
because we know so much about that guy, but like just kind of a vignette kind of piece, seeing, you know, young Da Vinci and Da Vinci in kind of his different modes. Da Vinci as the inventor, as the engineer, as the you know, brilliant painter. You
as
know,
a girl with cellophane wings standing before an audience.
You know, all of those things. I think he would be a cool subject for a film, particularly an animated film, because I think when you think of artists who would be wildly imaginative and would see the world through the lens of their own imagination and just crazy shit would be everywhere, that's definitely that kind of guy. So that would be really awesome. And, you know, animated Renaissance Italy, man, that would be badass. So, yeah, bring me some of that.
Gotta say, really awesome questions this session.
Yeah, y'all stepped your game up. This is great stuff. I think that's a show. We're out of stuff to talk about. Do you have any other closing thoughts?
Yeah, that's great. It's you know, the perfect length to just sit back, enjoy. It's structured well to the point where you can absorb everything that needs to be. It leaves on a good note.
Yeah, I think this film is just the right length to keep you engaged without becoming tedious. Overall, really enjoyed it. Definitely one I would want to revisit again sometime. You know, in the pantheon of auteur Japanese movies, Japanese anime movies, not like a super heavyweight, but this is a good movie.
I think what it really excels at is drawing interest to something that actually exists, so you can watch the movie, Google, explore, come back to it, and realize all that the movie has done, and then enjoy it all the more, which is
right.
Some pretty great art.
Yes, absolutely. And not only great art, and not only does it have a great artist in it, it has two great artists in it, and one of which finally kind of gets her day in the sun. And that's really great. I think that there's a live-action Japanese show, not Miss Hokusai, but it is Hokusai and his daughter, and the daughter's kind of the main focus again. But I think it's like an NHK. I forget where. I swear I saw something like that. And I'm going to see if I can find it. If I can, I'll put it in the show notes. But you know, it seems like Oye is getting a bit of recognition, broader recognition now, finally. Mm-hmm. So that's awesome. And I'm glad that this movie is one step on that path. But yeah, good stuff. So that is it for us for this month for Inc. and for myself. Thank you very much, and thank you for listening, and thank you for tuning in each month. We really appreciate it. Inc., where can people find you on the internet?
So many places. Too many places. I'll start with Otaku USA. Subscribe to Otaku USA magazine. You'll get stuff in your mailbox, and Lord knows where it'll bring you, but maybe places you never thought you might have wanted to go. Go to otakuusamagazine.com and subscribe. You get not only features and reviews by me, but so many other talented writers, way more talented than myself. Also, anagamers.com, where I have this little thing called Otaku No Radio, where I host with this magnificent person named Jared, and also where we do 3-episode tests every season, so you might be able to look at things you may not have thought of looking into before based upon your favorite Anagamers reviewers' thoughts. There's also fandompost.com, where I do 10 years later, where I look back on series that have aired 10 years ago and see how they stood up. Other than that, also Taiku Podcast. I am their official bad sports anime correspondent. And there is so much in the next season we are going to get to. You want to listen to, trust me. How about you, Jared?
I am on Twitter at Save versus Jared. Also, occasionally contributing to Anagamers.com. Haven't done anything in a while, but we're talking about that. So that might be something happening here in the not too distant future. And of course, we do have 3-episode tests on the horizon with the spring 2018 season rapidly approaching. I will also give a shout out to Taiku Podcast. They are gonna be doing a show on March Comes In Like a Lion fairly soon, and I think I'm gonna be on that. I'm really excited to talk with the guys about that. That's gonna be so fun. I love that show so much. So looking forward to that. Other than that, that's pretty much
it. What about your gaming website?
Well, there is Electrum Edition, which has some great content on it. Please go really check that out. That's at Electrum Edition on Twitter. Absolutely want to get more stuff out there. Just been really busy with a new job and playing a lot of D&D 5th Edition lately, and having some interesting thoughts on that. And hoping to start working on a game design for an RPG concept, and hoping to blog about that as I kind of go through my process, and hoping to hear from people and their thoughts on their own game design process or what they would want to do. So hoping to get to that soon. I keep saying hoping because work's got me real busy and I haven't been able to put much content out like I'd like to, but I am working on it, and hopefully we get to some more very soon.
Also, although we haven't mentioned it in a long time, and we're kind of ashamed for it, do listen to Anna Gamer's podcast proper. They are the main meat of the site. And also, join us on Discord. We have a direct link to chat with Jared and I and Evan and David and all the wonderful people of Anna Gamer's. It's just a lovely way to commune and talk and, suggest things. We love to hear from you.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do. And absolutely, Evan and David are killing it lately on the Anna Gamers podcast, so absolutely check that out.
Pun masters.
So I think that's all for this month, guys. Thank you again so much. And
wait, Jared.
Wait,
how about Dead Leaves?
We almost went a whole podcast without talking about Dead Leaves. Oh, God.
What about our Dead Leaves podcast?
It's coming, guys.
What?
I think the bet now is, do I get something out on Electrum Edition before we do something on Dead Leaves and get Dead Leaves out there? But fear not. Fear not. Dead Leaves is coming. One day soon. So I'm like, okay, I had this profound artistic experience. How can I balance myself back out into being just an idiot?
Well, the answer is anime.
Always. Always. Always turn to anime to save you from your higher thoughts and ideals. Big love, Evan. Big love. All right. So Vinny is asking, quite enjoyed the film. That's not a question, but that's great. I think I lost a...
Oh, that's great.
So I've even used that joke before. Come on.
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm 4 beers in, man. God.
I'm looking forward to the day where, like, Evan actually forwards us some hate mail. That's going to be great.